Pod Show. We're broadcasting live from the fabulously fluoridated capital of Auckland, New Zealand, the island chained nation in the sunny slave South Pacific. It's freaking gorgeous down here. And everybody's real wealthy too. Because of the Fukushima radiation, everybody managed to snap up a part-time job as an incandescent light bulb. The Prime Minister, John Key, formerly of the Federal Reserve, recommended it. My very special guest today, and today's a kind of auspicious day. I didn't even know this until this morning. But wasn't it like Veterans Day weekend or it's Veterans Day or something of that nature in the States? We have a similar thing called Anzac Day. And on Anzac Day, everybody gets up. There's a dawn ceremony. They stand in front of the big giant war memorial in front of the New Zealand Museum, which I think my great-grandfather kind of carved the faces around the museum, I found out. But what they do is say, oh, aren't the veterans great? Aren't they noble? Aren't they brave? And we will honour them by not giving them any medical benefits, by demonising the frack out of them, by turning them into terrorists. That's come out in the US press. Yes, if you're a veteran, you're on the terror watch list. Returning veterans are the number one doohickey to be worried about, apparently, these days. And then, in order to compensate them for dying or living with debilitating Agent Orange-related diseases for decades, they lay a wreath. Isn't that just beautiful? They obviously give a frack, don't they? They obviously care about the veterans. They're not just paying lip service to it so that they can frack us all in the ass, are they? My very special guest today is a veteran himself, who indeed worked at the Department of Defense. I'm not sure if he's seen an awful lot of combat, but we'll find out. And what Veterans Day means to him. Douglas Dietrich, welcome to the program.
Thank you so much, Mr. Eastwood. And it's an honor to be here with yourself and the audience of American Freedom Radio Network. And very much am honored by this opportunity on this particular day. It is Veterans Day weekend here in the United States, and it's also Remembrance Day in the Dominion of Canada and within Australia, or rather the weekend thereof. I believe that they've just come out of that weekend for both of those nations. And in the United States, we're basically... We had the holiday yesterday, but we're celebrating it or taking the day off federally today. So thank you for clarifying everything that you did about Anzac Day as well. And like most people, it's very difficult to keep track of these things. As a matter of fact, in America, we've got it subdivided enough where we've got Veterans Day for the living veterans of conflict who are lucky enough to have survived. We have Memorial Day for all of those who were unfortunate enough to die. And we have Armed Forces Day for those unlucky enough to still be in service.
I loved how you broke that down with the lucky and the unlucky, which is it's pretty funny because it's all pretty messed up because a lot of the people who have survived aren't the lucky ones.
It's so true.
They come home with post-traumatic stress and debilitating chronic illnesses and stuff like that, for which they're never even given any proper cures or treatments or anything like that. They just, you're just depressed. Here, take some Prozac for that post-traumatic stress syndrome. It'll make you either kill yourself or kill your family and then yourself, but never mind.
I hear you, and it is a great tragedy, and oftentimes, not that I'm defending the Veterans Administration in any way, shape, or form, oftentimes treatments are not really administered because so many of these conditions are, in a very real sense, untreatable. What they can treat are the symptoms, but they really cannot cure the effects of real heavy-duty exposure to Agent Orange, cyclosorine nerve gas, such as what I was exposed to, or depleted uranium, such as what all too many men are exposed to. And also, let's not forget the civilians in the nations where depleted uranium is distributed, such as Serbia, or in particular, Yaladak, where the nation has literally been dusted and has suffered the radiological equivalent of 44,000 Hiroshima-sized atomic bombs, essentially distributed across that area of the world, which has rendered it strategic. It's known as strategic area denial. It's rendered it inaccessible for a lot of oil development and kept the oil prices high.
And also, there's another element to this. Birth defects now in Iraq, approximately one in four. children that are born are deformed, some really massively with two heads or six arms, you know, really, really horrific stuff. Now, could you imagine, ladies and gentlemen, I want you to just kind of picture this. You walk down the street and every fourth person has an extra arm or an extra head or an extra leg or has their heart on the outside of their chest or their skin looks like it was burned by napalm, something of that nature. Would you still want to use depleted uranium?
You know, I am left speechless at the horror of what happened in throughout the Gulf War. And I need to make it a point that people need to realize that the second Gulf War started in basically in 1991. The preparations for it started in 1990 with Operation Desert Shield. And it actually started with Operation Desert Storm to be an actual armed conflict. And because of that, we've been in the longest undeclared war in America's history, longer than Vietnam. Because even though there was a cessation of proactive prosecution of that armed conflict was never declared or undeclared, and sanctions and violation of Iraqi airspace by Americans enforcing no-fly zones continued well after Operation Desert Storm into what became known as Operation Iraqi Freedom. And as a result, the depleted uranium continued to be dusted throughout the region of al-Iraq and then blown into its environs, like al-Kuwait. And the end result is exactly what you said. You have alarmingly high increases in heretofore rare and even unknown diseases, primarily in children. And Iraqi health officials presented a study of the state of affairs to the United Nations and said increases mostly were leukemia, carcinoma, meaning cancers, primarily of the lungs and digestive systems, late-term miscarriages, congenital diseases, and deformities in fetuses, which were primarily anencephaly, or a total absence of the brain, as well as fused fingers and fused toes. And these deformities are simultaneously manifesting in the babies of American Gulf War veterans. And just to differentiate this from Gulf War One, Gulf War One was between al-Iraq and Iran, and that was from 1980 to 1988. And so I personally saw some of the effects of that war when I was there in Baghdad as a civilian, and that was in the summer of 88. But so that was when al-Iraq was our great ally of the United States, and they were staving off fundamentalist Shia theocratic, mullahocratic Iran at the time. And now things have changed really drastically in terms of the geopolitical chessboard, and we're all paying the price. This was done under the Bush Sr. administration, and George Bush Sr. was a cold warrior, and he very much looked on this as very similar to the Korean War. When he attacked al-Iraq, he felt it was like attacking North Korea. And just as the original President Truman did not have an objective of invading North Korea, but rather maintaining a geopolitical equilibrium with South Korea and maintaining a status quo, when al-Iraq began to take a lot of advisors and a lot of supplies from the Soviet Union, which was still extant under Mikhail Gorbachev, then Bush Sr. considered al-Iraq to be a Soviet satellite. And at that point, he decided upon the invasion of al-Kuwait that this was similar to North Korea invading South Korea. He was very fossilized. He was stuck in time. And he launched a massive effort to retake al-Kuwait. And we're all paying the price for that today. He maintained a static equilibrium at the time. His son wasn't satisfied with that. And the end result is the conflict that we have with Americans inside al-Iraq, and this is very much a nuclear war. The Iranians recognize this because Iranian insurgents who go into al-Iraq have engaged Americans in conflict, and whenever they return to Iran, before they cross the border, they take off whatever clothes they were wearing as insurgents, and they burn them to prevent them from carrying radioactive isotopes with themselves back beyond that border into their home nation. Now, American troops don't do this at all. They roll in it. Like, it's terrible. They bring it home, and they are impacted in every way imaginable. and it's passed on to their children. And the Gulf War immunodeficiency syndrome, which is not recognized by the Veterans Administration. What is recognized by the Veterans Administration is something called Gulf War syndrome. Gulf War syndrome is a legal fiction that was created so they could start treating them in any way imaginable. They didn't know how to treat such a variety of symptoms, but Congress realized that there were enough symptoms that were extant that some way or another the VA had to be forced to treat those symptoms. And so since they could not cure what was known unofficially as Gulf War immunodeficiency syndrome, then what Congress recognized as a legal fiction was Gulf War syndrome, so they could at least start passing out antidepressants. So that's the sad story behind that affair. And I could go into it in far greater detail.
Let me guess. The military and the pharmaceutical industry are intimately connected.
Yes. Oh,
and so,
very much.
And so, hold on. They send a guy over, get him sick. When he comes back, the sickness that they caused, they deny it exists, but they say that he's got another disease for which they can prescribe him a drug that they own and make more money off of his sickness after they sent him over there to get the sickness.
It's disgusting. And, you know, I would weep if it's one of those situations which is the typical catch-22 of the military. And it's very important to remember that when I was a Department of Defense research librarian for almost a decade, my post was El Presidio Real de San Francisco. And that, of course, was extremely important, as I've emphasized before, because the United Nations was established there January 1st of 1942 as an organization of war per Title 42 of the United Nations Charter. In lieu of a constitution, they have a charter. And because of all the international records I was dealing with, that in itself leads us down many other rabbit holes or trails. But since we're talking about the military medical industrial complex, let's talk about pharmacopoeia for a bit. And while we're in that direction, Letterman Army Medical Center was on site, El Presidio. And that was one of the most advanced medical facilities that the United States military had. As a matter of fact, 25% of all military doctors, all Army doctors, excuse me, were trained at the Letterman Army Medical Center. And one of the things that I learned there as a DOD librarian, I had to work as liaison not only with the United States Army's officially recognized satanic chaplain, I also had to liaise with the Letterman Army Medical Center Medical Library and their medical librarians. I had to relieve them when they were on vacation or during shift spells, etc. There were various other situations that made me maintain constant contact with them. As a DOD librarian, I was supposed to be dealing with unit records or unit histories, but not personnel records or personnel histories. So oftentimes these records would get incredibly conflated. A lot of people need to come to grips with the fact in the United States that this is not a Mission Impossible fantasy where everything is well maintained and you have these like sirens and alarms and cameras that surround every records facility. Quite the opposite is true. The government is the low end of the spectrum of records-keeping technology. And because of the conflation of not just unit records with personnel records, but the conflation of personnel records so that three people named Smith would have their life histories conflated into a single dossier, you also have situations where while these various librarians try to sort things out, they learn quite a bit about each other's libraries. So I got quite familiar with the medical library at the Presidio. There were many experiments that were being conducted there on not just animals, which created an enormous amount of protests that were constantly outside the gate of the Presidio military base, the Lombard Gate as it was known mostly. People were protesting the fact that they experimented quite heavily with dogs. This is why you get such a misdirection of well-meaning and well-intentioned yet very naive journalists like Ron Johnson, I believe his name is, who wrote The Men Who Stare at Goats. And when Ron Johnson was interviewing many of the men who were involved with the more occult or occulted or secreted aspects of military research, one of the things that they told him was they fed him the big lie that, oh, dogs are man's best friend, and we just couldn't get our soldiers to kill dogs or use them as targets. Okay, this is absurd, because at the Presidio military base, I was personally witness at the Letterman Army Medical Center to them experimenting with explosive bullets, poison bullets, various other munitions, including chemical and biological, on thousands of dogs. They would kill dogs to the point where they were in massive piles. As a matter of fact, they had an unholy alliance going on with breeders, mostly in Texas, who were breeding dogs to the point where the female dogs they were breeding would have their uteruses collapse and expose themselves on the outside of the dog's body from birthing so much. And these breeders were breeding dogs in illegal kennels for, according to the media, or the way the media was given the story, for dog fighting purposes. But the reality was many of them went to the
Well, hold on, Douglas, we're coming to a break. Ladies and gentlemen, you listen to the Vinnie Eastwood Show, my very special guest, Douglas Dietrich, and it's Veterans Day weekend celebration. So if you're a veteran, the number is 218-339-8525 if you'd like to call in. 218-339-8525. We'll be right back.
Because it's Wednesday, and Wednesday night is the night that we usually make love. It's because it's when everything is just right. There's nothing good on TV. You haven't had your social netball team practice, so you're not too tired. Oh yeah, sounds like it's all on. You say something to me like, I might go to bed, I've got work in the morning. But I know what you mean. You mean, oh yeah, it's business time, it's business time.
It's business, it's business time.
That's what you mean it's business time. Oh.
It's business, it's business time.
Oh yeah, that's right. We go brush our teeth, that's all part of
Welcome
it, that's foreplay.
You go Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen,
that's not part of
to
it,
the show
that's very important.
It's all about foreplay. It's the Vinnie Eastwood Show on AmericanFreedomRadio.com. It's Veterans Weekend. We're doing a wee special here today. We're hoping to connect up Charlie McGrath. And Charlie, if you're listening, please call into the switchboard, 218-339-8525, and we'll get you on that way. My very special guest today is, in fact, Douglas Dietrich, none other than. And I was just thinking, you know, what's Veterans Day about really for veterans? And if you are one, please call in. Did you, like Lieutenant Dan and Forrest Gump, spend Veterans Day slumped over a bottle of Jack nursing your stumps? Or something of that, horrible nature? Please call in, 218-339-8525, because I think it's people are if you're not in the military, you have no idea, right? That's what a lot of people believe. Whereas I find that if you speak to a lot of people in the military, you at least begin to have some idea. And I have. And they all tell similar stories. No veteran that I've ever talked to has been overly and 100% appreciative of their service. There's always been bad things that have happened to them or their friends, terrible things that they've seen and terrible things that they've done and terrible things that perhaps continue to happen to them long after they're out. That's the reality in my based upon my conversations with many veterans, and I'm sure you'll probably concur with that, Douglas.
Yes, very much so. I can't see your face on camera anymore, but that's fine. Your voice is quite expressive, and I'll move along with that. I certainly want to emphasize the fact that, unfortunately, for many of the military men who are still in service, the doctors are not your best friend any more than they are in the civilian world. Many of the medical experiments that were conducted on civilians through the human radiation experiments that were exposed through the President's Advisory Committee in the Clinton administration that was investigating these crimes against humanity – Many of those MDs were involved in the civilian world with the University of Rochester, the UCSF, where I earned my accredited equivalent of a master's degree in medical journalism. Many of these people were involved with University of Boston and many other prestigious universities. So the end result was that what people need to realize is that the more prestigious the academic university medically, the more it's going to be up for government contracts, and the more that it's MDs as well. Well, as his professors are willing to prostitute themselves and basically sell out the quality of life of their patients or even the very life of their patients for the sake of whatever the military pays them to experiment with. And I could go through a list of some of those atrocities and have done so in the past, but in terms of the military, it becomes even worse. In military medicine, the mission, not the patient, comes first. And when I was working at the Presidio Military Base, Edmund G. Howe, H-O-W-E, of the Uniformed Services University, put it this way. He said the military physician accepts the obligation to place military interests over his own interests and those he might otherwise have as a civilian doctor when he becomes a military officer. He is, in a sense, primarily a soldier with a special technical expertise. And thus, when during combat, the soldier comes to the military physician with an injury, both the soldier and the physician have agreed to prioritize the needs of the military. Now, all that might seem quite dutiful and honorable, but it's taken to as carte blanche to really turn all military men into lab rats. And this is why Dr. Harold Appel, APPEL, whose records I had to deal with at the Department of Defense, this is why he became a conscientious objector during 1969. That's when he had his hearing at the height of the Vietnam conflict. And he quoted Navy documents that led him to conclude that the purpose of the Medical Corps was to enable the fighting force to attain its mission, not to heal the sick, and that he later on published a letter in the New England Journal of Medicine that urged any doctor considering a military career to realize the fact that the purpose of of the military is antagonistic to the goals of healing the sick, that the physician in the military is a soldier first and a doctor second. And as a direct result of this, military men have often been considered human ammunition or vectors for biowarfare. I think the ultimate example of this was in the First World War. I've been talking about that a lot recently, and I've been trying to expose that, give that the amount of public exposure that it deserves to have. And I need to put that into perspective for people so that they understand the veracity of what I'm saying and the seriousness of what I'm saying. But one of the original thoughts of using biological weapons came during the American Indian Wars. And during that period of time, after the American Civil War, the American Frontier Army fought no less than 1,400 battles with the Native Americans. And during that period of time, they grew extremely calloused to extermination. And when they led these various Indian Plains tribes onto various trails of tears to reservations, they would finish them off come winter time by offering them blankets that were infected with smallpox. And through this, they wiped out no less than 100,000 original peoples in the United States. And due to the efficacy of biological warfare as proven through the frontier wars, the United States Army was more than equipped and ready come the First World War. And what happened during the First World War was, of course, the Germans won. This is entirely unknown to most of the world, but on the Eastern Front, the Kaiser forced the Bolsheviks, after the abdication of the Tsar, into the Treaty of Brest-Litovsk. And with the Treaty of Brest-Litovsk, Bolshevik Russia surrendered one-third, or more so, 33% of her population to the Germans, a quarter, 25% of her territories, and over half, over 50% of her industries to Germany. At that point, the Kaiser's position was unassailable, and nothing could have ousted his regime short of an atomic bomb on Berlin, which did not exist at the time. And it's important to emphasize would not have worked in Hitler's time because of his bunkering complex and the technologies of that era. But during the Kaiser's time, what the Americans had was a different type of super weapon, and that was the plague. that they had perfected and used against the Indians. So what they used to incept the plague was they basically conscripted convicts out of San Quentin Penitentiary. It's a penitentiary in the state where I live, California. And they shipped all of these live conscripts out of San Quentin in unrefrigerated boxcars to Fort Lewis, Kansas area. And there, inside of these unrefrigerated boxcars, they were riding with cages full of live chickens and therefore forced to inhale in direct proximity for hours and hours of train ride, days of train ride, the particulate matter of feathers and fecal matter as shedded and secreted by these chickens. And they contracted what's known as chicken roll. And by the time that they reached Fort Lewis, Kansas area, they were all bivouacked in basically a hastily built cantonment that was called Cap Funston. And that was on the Fort Riley Military Reservation of Haskell County, Kansas. And these were about 56,000 recruits that were mixed up with these convicts. And they developed what at that time became known as the avian flu. This was H1N1. It was hemagglutinin 1, neuromodase 1. And this was the most virulent and deadly bioweapon ever incepted by man. It's a variant of the hemorrhagic fever, and it was so deadly that it was killing people off too quickly to spread. So they had to wait until the mortality ratios died down, because a bioweapon cannot spread effectively unless it kills only 10 to 20% of its victims. And once it reached that level of mortality ratio, they found the patient known as the index patient in which that lower mortality ratio virus had manifested. And his name was Albert Gitchell. Family name was spelled G-I-T-C-H-E-L-L. And they made Albert Gitchell, as soon as they discovered this, they made him cook. And he started cooking for all 56,000 men. He spread that disease. All these men were thrown across the Atlantic to hit Spain. Spain was a nominally neutral nation, but played very fast and loose with its neutrality. The Americans arrived in what were known as coffin ships because the vast majority of them arrived dead. And the American Expeditionary Forces hit the field like the conquistadors hit the New World, spreading a disease which no one on the continent had ever suffered from before. And by the time they hit the fields of France and got into the trenches, which were just miles and miles of constructs that, if laid end to end, would encircle the earth, they got in there, and at that point in time, every soldier in the field, Central Powers or Allied, became afraid of one thing. They weren't afraid of gas. They weren't afraid of bayoneting or bullets or dying by explosives. They were all afraid of catching the flu. And because when you caught that flu, you would die within 24 hours. And ultimately, it destroyed all industrial production in Germany because children would kiss their fathers goodbye. They would go to work in the factories, and they wouldn't come home. And there was blowback in America. 20 million people died. There were two waves of this avian/swine flu, which manifested, which were never reported in order to maintain wartime morale. And they ran out of coffins in 1 week. And worldwide, they killed 100 million people. It edged out the Black Plague in fatality ratios. It killed more people in 24 hours than AIDS has killed in 25 years. It killed more people in a single year than the Black Plague killed in an entire century during the Middle Ages. This was truly the most heinous war crime ever launched against humanity. But you've never heard of it. The Americans have managed to hide this from you. And this was known in American medical records, which I dealt with at the Letterman Army Medical Center, as Army Flu. And the end result is the world we have today, which is genetically altered. It killed so many people. The modern-day equivalent of the 100 million that it killed in World War I would be a billion people dead and another billion people whose lives would be shortened by 15 years due to surviving the ravages of lung damage as caused by that flu. And it puts the immune system into overdrive. Only the young and the healthy die. Infants' immune systems are not developed enough to be affected by it. The elderly, their immune systems are too weakened to be affected by it. But for the young and healthy, primarily young males of combat age or industrial labor age, their immune systems go into overdrive and it creates what's known as a cytokinetic storm. Your lungs begin to dissolve and you cough them up in a pink phlegm. And cities were unable to deal with this, even in the United States. Within a week, when they ran out of coffins, they had to organize mass graves, shallow graves in which to bury hundreds of people at a time. And they had to dig these graves ultimately with steam shovels and bury people with steam shovels. That's how much of an effect it had. And yet they managed to totally hide this from the history books, even the fact that it genetically altered all of humanity. There were so many people killed that they know that there were entire bloodlines and entire genetic strains of humanity that were wiped out. So our entire genetic destiny was altered by the American application of a bioweapon on an unprecedented scale. So for this reason alone, the American Empire truly is the evil empire, far superseding that of the Third Reich or the Soviet Union. That needs to be put into perspective. And it was used in terms of this weakness of medical doctors and their callousness towards the troops, considering them. Yes, go on.
There is that element that the U.S. is now worse than the Third Reich and worse than communist Russia ever was. And I believe that's because under Operation Paperclip, they recruited all the top Nazis and put them into top positions in the U.S. administration. And now with the implementation of the Department of Homeland Security, they are in fact hiring the ex-heads of the KGB who set up their spy networks to do for America what was done to communist Russia. So in essence, it's got the best of both worlds.
But, you know, that's an escape valve, and that's a rationalization. What you say is historically true, but it's really overblown. Like I've emphasized with Nexus Magazine, which sources out of Australia, and basically the Americans could teach the Axis and the communist powers quite a bit, and they didn't need foreign instructors to teach them anything. The truth is that Operation Paperclip was not so much to bring Nazi scientists over here to instill their methodology or their technologies. The truth is that Operation Paperclip was more like a technical observation program, and all of those scientists involved with Operation Paperclip were considered observers of a foreign power in exile. The Dritte Macht, the third power, the Third Reich in exile, which had relocated initially to Argentina and then to Antarctica and then to environs further underground, quite literally. So in terms of that, it's not so much that the Americans were learning things from what the American Empire was doing to itself. And so with that in mind, hopefully after the break at the bottom of the hour, we can...
Yeah, indeed. Ladies and gentlemen, wartime is not a peaceful time. And ultimately, I've got this this perspective. I think it was Bob Chapman who says, you know, you do anything that's necessary to avoid a war. Anything, okay? Because once it's in your home, once it's among you, there really ain't no escape, even once it's over. We'll be right back after the break at thevinnieeastwoodshow.com. Gentlemen, to the Vinnie Eastwood Show. We're broadcasting live on AmericanFreedomRadio.com. It's the Veterans Day weekend special with my very, very special specialist guest, Douglas Dietrich. And you can call in and join the conversation, 218-339-8525. That's 218-339-8525. Douglas, welcome back.
Yes, it's great to be here. And so with your permission, Mr. Eastwood, I'd like to go into how the callousness of some of these military doctors and the kind of almost maniacal pragmatism that they had was actually used against them by the enemy. We were mentioning the Axis powers and the transfer of a lot of scientists after the war. I'd like to express what happened during the war so we can get much more of a mature opinion of how they were acting and how it impacted their own men and their own war effort.
Well, before you do, I've got a very bad taste joke. Do you know what Iraq veterans, what kind of flowers they get on Veterans Day?
Oh, I shudder to think. What?
Depleted geraniums.
Oh, that is terrible. Oh, I'm sorry. That's almost offensive, Mr. Eastwood. But it is the lighter side of genocide, and that's what we're famous for on this. If we don't laugh, we're going to cry. So we do want to emphasize that part. I still can't see Mr. Eastwood's face, so all I see is right now the image of Satan in my mind. Well, he tossed that up. But at any rate, good sir, yeah, and what's happening with depleted uranium, of course, we're going to be paying the price for literally thousands of years. Or I think it's going to take all of humanity and a concerted universal effort on part of the planet to clean up and detoxify areas like Al-Iraq, to a lesser extent, Serbia, after the deployment of depleted uranium. It was a Serbian doctor, Dr. Dorakovic, who was one of the men in charge of the Veterans Administration, who out of his own pocket, because the Veterans Administration would not foot the bill, paid for the testing of the genetics of the cellular damage as suffered by Gulf War II vets, vets from my era of the Gulf War, Operation Desert Storm, who volunteered to have him test them for their cellular damages since the time of their service. And he was able to prove that they suffered the cellular equivalent of damage as if they had been undergoing chemotherapy for the vast majority of their adult lives. That's how much radiation they had been exposed to and how much it had damaged their cells, which is why they were sterile and suffering from any number of other ailments. And once he discovered that, then he was fired. That goes without saying. But he indisputably proved the fact that depleted uranium is a radiological weapon, and therefore the wars as were waged by NATO in Serbia and the wars as were waged by the Allied coalition in the Al-Iraq are nuclear wars. So this is the horror of the 20th and the 21st centuries that we have yet to even confront. And we have not even confronted the use of biological warfare in the Second World War and what happened with that in such a way that the Americans paid the price for their own cruelty. In this sense, what had happened was during the Second World War, very shortly after Pearl Harbor, Emperor Hirohito was still determined that only military men would die and that his targets against the West were going to be, if at all possible, particularly against the Americans, purely military. It needs to be emphasized that at Pearl Harbor, the Japanese killed not one single civilian. That is something that is never emphasized. Not one single civilian died at Pearl Harbor. As a matter of fact, the Japanese didn't destroy the oil fields at Pearl Harbor that were wide open for bombing and out in the open and vulnerably exposed because they realized that that would not only kill civilians in area, but that would also deprive civilians of heating and gas for cooking, et cetera, and various other supplies that would result in civilian fatalities in the future. Again, this was under orders of the emperor that this was a precise surgical military strike. Now, civilians did die at Pearl Harbor, but the Americans never tell you about that because all the civilians who died at Pearl Harbor were killed by Americans who died under friendly fire. Now, when Emperor Hirohito had already stolen around 1928 yellow fever samples that were brought back to Japan and weaponized, needs to be remembered that Emperor Hirohito was a marine biologist. And as a marine biologist, he was personally overseeing Unit 731, Unit 100, various other biowarfare development units and facilities that were mostly on mainland Asia. And as a result, he knew exactly what he was doing, and he knew how to titrate down or graduate down the virility of the viruses he was working with. He kept them at extremely virulent levels in China so that they couldn't spread and wipe out the entire population. And the vast majority of people statistically in China would be born, live, and die within a 10-mile radius. So he could basically infect an entire village or a walled city to wipe out resistance without it vectoring into the entire countryside. America was a different thing entirely. And once Hideo Noguchi, who was the Michio Kaku of his day, a celebrity scientist who had claimed that he had isolated trachoma, the yellow fever, syphilis, and various other diseases, about half a dozen diseases. This was an extraordinary claim for a single scientist. Most scientists never isolate more than one disease in their life, if any at all. He became a celebrity, and it was all a lie. He wasn't a scientist. He was a spy. And Hideo Noguchi was able to use this claim that he made to go into laboratories and universities all over the United States and get viral samples. He ultimately died carrying one of these viral samples, in this case yellow fever, back to Japan. And when he died of yellow fever in 1928, a young marine biologist, the Emperor of Japan himself, was able to weaponize that yellow fever. And the Americans knew this, and yet Emperor Hirohito still demanded more. And he had Dr. Ryoichi Neto basically asked for yellow fever samples by showing up unexpectedly at the Rockefeller Institute back in 1939 at the dawn of war on continental Europe. And he got the Americans all on edge. Now, Hirohito didn't need these samples. He wanted the Americans to think he was after them for an even more aggressive program. And there were several other feints, F-E-I-N-T-S, or false maneuvers like that in the very near future, that got the Americans expecting biological attack by the time of Pearl Harbor. And shortly after Pearl Harbor, when the emperor sent Japanese dirigibles over Los Angeles during what became known as the Battle of Los Angeles on the night of February 24th through the night of February 25th, these dirigibles used the Japan current, the jet stream, to get all the way from Japan to America, floated down south using the California current, then floated back towards the Empire of Japan using the equinoctial current. And at that point in time, the Empire of Japan stretched all the way down past the equator. So it was very easy for them to make this circuit without even using very, very much fuel at all. And in terms of what they deployed nothing. They hovered over Los Angeles and took fire for the night. And when they had left, moved out of area of Los Angeles, the Americans assumed they must have been distributing aerosolized biocidal weapons, particularly yellow fever. So the American high command went into a panicked action, and the MDs responded by distributing a yellow fever vaccination, which they cobbled together, a witch's brew, out of aborted fetuses and human cadavers that had not been approved by the FDA. And they wrote Los Angeles off. They said, the city of Los Angeles has been infected with yellow fever. We've got to immunize all of the troops in area and kill everybody who leaves Los Angeles. So when they got all of these troops immunized to do that, they wound up, thanks to the witch's brew that they deployed, infecting them all with various gradations of hepatitis. And as it turns out, no less than 51,000 military personnel were to die once they started immunizing them on April 15th of 1942. And or rather, that's when they halted it. They halted all the immunizations on April 15th of 1942. They began them right after the Battle of Los Angeles, so forgive me for that. But in terms of the result, another 330,000 were affected with a lesser degree of hepatitis, where they suffered massive liver debilitation. Point where they had to be severed from active duty. So by this one act, without expending a single shell or killing a single civilian, Emperor Hirohito wiped out over four divisions of American troops. And that was the equivalent of Japan's Stalingrad or Leningrad. They managed to basically defeat the American war effort because they extended the war by 4 years. The Americans were placing only 15% of all of their industrial and manpower resources into the Pacific. They were already fighting with eviscerated force levels. The reason why was because they knew Japan could have only 10% the industrial capacity in terms of output that they had calculated, miscalculated rather, and of what the United States could produce. So being eminently racist, they deployed only 15% of all they had to the Pacific theater, and of that 15%, fully a third of it had to go north to dislodge the Japanese invasion of the Aleutian Island chains of Alaska. And as a result, the war was essentially brought to a stalemate, effectively, by Emperor Hirohito and the Battle of Los Angeles. This is why the U.S. High Command was so desperate to hide that as alien and an alien intervention.
Well, isn't that interesting? And I was just thinking about this as well. You know how people see UFOs all over the place and they go, oh, it might be a spaceman or something like that. This idea, do you have any idea how many classified military aircraft there are that have ridiculous, amazing abilities that just simply don't get released to the public? You say it's a UFO. Sure, it's an unidentified flying object. But who's the pilot? And you wonder, how long has this kind of technology been out there? How long has it been going on? And how long have they been using the story of UFOs to cover up what they're really doing? You listen to the Vinnie Eastwood Show. My very special guest is Douglas Dietrich, and we'll have him on for another hour right after the break. Join us then. And he's got like this native stone back wall with Wide Awake News set into it. Like he's
Blarney
got
stone.
By chance, did that wall come with a drawbridge and a moat?
It's my Blarney stone.
He's like coming out from the Wide Awake News castle on top of Wyoming Hill, overlooking the many, many giant, gargantuan, genetically modified cattle that graze so delicately on the on the Monsanto supergrass that comes out your ass.
This is the stronghold. This is the stronghold. This is where we're holding. This is the bunker location.
Yeah. It does remind me of the background for an aquarium. It would do really nice for that.
Yeah, well, you know, I think, Charlie, you should also get yourself a little treasure chest and a little diver on a string kind of thing to hang on either side of you as well.
Just swimming around me?
A bubble machine, too, would probably
there you
work.
Go. Be like, fuck.
Bubbles. All right, well, anyway. Welcome,
you,
Charlie. I'm really good, and over the break I was just thinking of Charlie the Unicorn. If anybody's ever seen Charlie the Unicorn, it's freaking funny, eh? Charlie! It's a funny YouTube video. Go Google it if you haven't seen it. And I remember talking...
Have you seen the Charlie Bit My Finger YouTube video? Charlie Bit My Finger. Sounds like a New Zealander.
Well, funny you should mention that, because I was talking with Charlie Veach about this, and one time some people came up to him in the street just going, Charlie, and he's like,
what's going on, yeah.
As you do. Well, anyway, it's Veterans Day weekend, Charlie, and you've been in the military yourself, and we've been talking over and over about how basically you go there, you get traumatized or injured or something, and then you come back, and it's like, do you ever wind up regretting your military service, or is it basically it's just part of your life, you know, like a bag of Legos, it's just a few extra blocks that you can build something else out of.
Yeah, I don't know. I guess that'd be. That would be individual case by case basis, I suppose. But I mean, you know, I had a lot of good friends when I was in the military, and a lot of good experiences. You know, I lived in Germany for several years, and that was fun. I mean, there's a lot of fun things that were associated with it. But certainly, I think I know a lot of people who are really messed up. You know, mentally messed up, physically messed up, and their lives were changed for the worse. Because of their military service, you know, I think in the military is important for a nation to be strong, and if we used our military in the way the Constitution prescribed, I would absolutely be 100% the most patriotic guy in this country, the most gung-ho, let's go get him and use our military in a constitutionally prescribed manner. But that isn't, of course, as you know, what we have. We have a system that we use our military to uphold corporate doctrine, and that I am dead set against, obviously, as well you are.
Yeah. And I got an article in here from my producer. It turns out that the petition to let Texas secede from the United States is to be reviewed by the White House. And you got to wonder as well, how bad do things have to get before, like any relationship, let's say you've got a relationship with a friend or a relationship with a woman, how bad does that relationship have to get before you have to just say, look, it's time to walk away? And this is what I'm seeing now with states in the U.S. and even the people of the United States.
Somebody told me once, breaking up with a girl or a guy, whatever the case is, you know, is like knocking over a vending machine. You got to rock it. You got to get the momentum going two or three times before it'll push all the way over. And I think that's the secession movement. We've heard talk of this. 2010, 2008, I think it's very interesting because it isn't just Texas. I'm sure you already know this. There's 20 states that have petitioned the government for peaceful withdrawal from the country and form their own government. Now they're all grabbing on to the Louisiana came out first and did this. Somebody put a petition up at usgovernment.gov or something like that, where these links take you to. Someone put a petition in there for Louisiana, and if it gets 25,000 signatures, then the White House has to look at it by their own rules. They have to respond to it, rather. But Louisiana went up, then a whole slew of other states went up there, and I think it's up to 20 now. And I think Texas was the closest to having the 25,000.
Charlie, actually, as of 3:40 p.m. Eastern Time, more than 25,000 Texans have already signed the petition on the White House website.
Excellent.
How many?
25,378 as of 3:40 p.m. Eastern Time.
Well, there you go. They have to respond to it. I think that's the first one. You know, about 2 hours ago, it was like 2,000 shy. But it was clear that it was going to be the first one to hit that 25,000 number, which will make it necessary for the White House to respond to that petition. I think it's interesting. I hope all these states, my state, Montana is one of them that's on there. I hope they all get to the 25,000 mark.
Oh, by the way,
just before you go on, I just thought of a great saying for this, for the states. In order to succeed as a state, you must secede from the United States.
That's no doubt. No doubt.
Yeah. Douglas?
I was just going to say to Mr. McGrath that he happens to be up in Montana, which is, of course, the state where my erstwhile co-writer David West lives. Be bringing him towards the end of the show when I'm bringing up, the availability of some books and DVDs that I try to disseminate information with to the public. And I just find it a running joke between Mr. West and myself. First off, he writes for me because I'm a terrible writer. I have, I was a DOD librarian for almost a decade, and I have this Department of Defense indoctrinated format, which makes it just totally inaccessible for easy reading, and it's just bureaucracies, and it's terrible, and everyone says that my writing is like reading a field manual or something like that. So it's just terrible. So I finally got a co-writer, and he's up there in Montana. My running joke is, of course, that there's no cities in Montana, that everybody lives in pup tents. And as a matter of fact, I believe that Mr. McGrath is bunkered in because they have,
That's
6 feet of snow outside, and only his friend Bigfoot can bring him supplies at this
That's
point.
That's right. I'm hunkered in. I got the generators going. You can see I'm in the castle. I got the rock behind me. Actually, it is very cold. Last night we were below zero here in Bozeman. It was about one below zero. We got about a foot of snow over the weekend, so it was it's cold. It's cold here. There's no doubt about it. But we do have cities, and you know one nice thing about the smaller states, population wise. I mean, Montana is a huge state geographically, population-wise, I think we're going to see more and more push for these kind of movements out of these smaller states. You know, Montana has 1 million people. We have 1 million people in our whole state. We're the fourth largest state in the union, geographically speaking. And, you know, it's a very independent type of person that lives here, mainly because if your forefathers came here, they came here to, you know, mine or to trap or to, you know, live in a freer life in the frontier. So that kind of is instilled in this area. But it is throughout the Rocky Mountain states. And I think we're going to see, if we see a true secessionist movement or a break off of any kind, absolutely between here and Texas somewhere, I think is where it'll take hold. And frankly, I hope it does, because, I mean, Vinny, look what we got. We got the exact same person. We got the exact same people running the so-called leadership in Washington, D.C. The banks are still in control. They're still writing legislation. We're still fighting amongst ourselves. Red team, blue team nonsense. So I think there's a lot of frustration, and I hope this thing continues. I hope it grabs, gets some traction and grabs hold, and I hope there really is a state that pushes this thing.
Right, and I want to add to what Mr. McGrath says in two areas, one concerning Texas, one concerning the secessionism of the West in general. And the first thing concerning Texas is that the entire state of Texas could literally secede tomorrow, and there is nothing the union could do about it. There are more privately owned firearms in the state of Texas than there are in the entire United States National Guard, which in the main is deployed overseas anyway. Yeah. And the whole point is that the United States government, the union, has been buying off Texas for decades, pretty much right. Since the end of the, in a sense, probably since the end of the First World War, by constantly, or at least around the time of the Second World War, by constantly deploying or redeploying military bases to Texas, which give it steroid shots in the arm in terms of its economy. You've had an entire Mexican middle class develop in the state of Texas that services those military bases in Texas. You could literally go for a jog in the state of Texas for a few hours, a real long jog, for say maybe 2-3 hours, a good marathon for yourself. You would run into about 2 or 3 military bases in that time on foot in certain areas of Texas. That's how, and every time they do this, they get a new president essentially out of Texas. As a matter of fact, that's why the Bushes moved down to Texas. They're not Texans, but Bush Sr. kept pretending he was a cowboy, and they're really Nor'easterners.
Didn't he grow up in, like, Maryland?
Yeah, they go down there It's part of Confederate revenge. Basically, the Confederacy has been given the Union really lousy presidents since Lyndon Baines Johnson all the way through Billy Jeff Clinton. You know, I mean, it's just – but in terms of aside from the smart-aleck remarks in that regard, what Texas could do immediately is, if it lost its military-based contracts, is all it needs to do is become a member state of OPEC. And at that point in time, it immediately – just recoups all of its lost finance. And so it's got a great future ahead of it, no matter what
it does. I think any state in the union could right now say, you know what, we're no longer participating in the Federal Reserve System. And you know, the debt that or the income and the debt owed would be null and void. And just, you know, that's what a secession movement would actually mean, is a freedom from the tyrannical Federal Reserve System and the creation of, you know, if Louisiana or Texas or wherever decides they're going to, you know, get the votes to do this and get the will of the people behind it to do it, then that would be the first step, which is you create your own money and you determine the value of the money in your new state, I guess, or whatever, republic government.
The element that I wanted to elaborate on here is that they're giving this secession to the White House for it to review. Now, what is the point exactly in the review? I mean, do you want to just sit and wait for this government to say, no, you can't secede, or yes, you can? And what would be the actions to take if they say, no, you can't leave the union?
Right. Well, I don't know. I guess we're going to find out. But it isn't like this petition is... You know, it isn't from the legislature of Louisiana. From what I understand, what I've read, and I've read on the actual government website, you know, the first initial one that the one that everybody has kind of grabbed hold of and then put their state's name in there as well. And each one of these is getting thousands of people to sign off on it. But it's basically just quotes from the either the Constitution or from great men in history, forefathers in history, quotes about redress of grievances, and if a government becomes no longer serves the people have the right to dissolve that government. A lot of state constitutions have that in their constitutions as well. Montana does, but you know, it isn't like the state legislature is going to Obama or the White House and saying we want to secede peacefully and waiting for permission, yes or no. I think a lot of it is done in protest. I mean, this has all been done in protest because of the election, the re-election of Obama, which in a way, I'm glad to see people starting to get a little worked up and motivated. But in a way, you know, there's a lot of people that think we had some kind of, this red team, blue team game was a real thing. And there's a lot of people in alternative media that actually believe that as well. Like we were going to get something different with Romney. And I think it's important to realize that we wouldn't have gotten anything different with Romney. We wouldn't. We've got the exact same policy. We'd have got the exact same president as we have right now. That ticks a lot of people off to hear that. But whoever's in that White House, now is serving special interests. They're serving the financial community. They're serving the military, security, industrial complex. So we get more war and more financial future stolen from the people and given to the hands of a very select elite few. It's good to see people getting upset. It's bad to see people pointing their finger at other people of this country saying, it's these liberals, it's these Democrats that is the fault. And the truth is, I believe that's part of the plan from the get-go, which is divide and conquer so we're fighting amongst ourselves rather than looking at the people who brought us to this place.
Well, yeah, right. And I spoke with Douglas this morning quite forcefully about how much of a frustrating exercise the elections were for me personally. That for the last 2 days, I didn't do any of my archiving, I didn't do any of my videos, I didn't answer any emails, I didn't go on Skype, I didn't do anything. And that was exactly what I needed to get over this, because it was been everywhere at all times.
That's a great plan.
Yes, withdrawal. I would like to mention, concerning the other aspect that Mr. McGrath brought up about the Western feeling of independence in general and how that might manifest, when I was with the DOD, which was until 1992, was when they closed the postal library at the department, at the DOD library, which was on post, the Presidio Military Base in San Francisco. The base itself was closed later in 1995. One of the things that I was constantly trying to do was I had this dream of laterally transferring over to the RAND/MIT or various other contracted think tanks for the U.S. government. And so at one point they were asking me, what would you predict for America's social future? So I was predicting civil war. I'd like to talk about that when we get back as to exactly how I felt that would fall down. And, get both of you gentlemen to have your opinions on it.
Indeed. All right, Charlie McGrath and Douglas Dietrich, my guests. I'm not sure if Charlie's going to be... Are you staying on over the segment, Charlie?
I can do one more segment, yes, sir.
Okay, cool. We'll be right back, folks.
Look at me driving and I won't stop. And it feels so good to be alive and on top. My reach is global, my tower secure, my cause is noble, my power is pure. I can hand out a million vaccinations, I'll let them all die in acceleration.
Gentlemen, to the Vinnie Eastwood Show, the show that's all about handing out 20 million vaccinations for the manufactured swine flu from Fort Detrick. Oh, God, you're going to love that covert bioweapon warfare that actually doesn't even kill anybody but gets hyped up. You know, hey, in fact, during the swine flu pandemic, there was like 20 people in the whole of New Zealand who died, right? And normally the normal flu kills about 1,000 people every year. And they had the words pandemic written in blood on the news.
Yeah, I'm not surprised.
Shocking all media.
Yeah. By the way, all flus, the reason that they incept generally out of Asia when they're natural, as opposed to the unnatural flu, the American Army flu, which incepted in World War One, they incept there because the population in general is still involved with sustenance agriculture, and they live with their poultry, and they live with their pigs, because they eat pork and on mainland Asia and into the peninsula, and even on Okinawa. And they also live with their chickens, and the chickens run under the house. And what happens is a lot of the chickens' fecal matter or particulate matter, such as shed feathers, will get into the feed of the pigs. It can't be helped because the pigs often roam. And they're all kind of like pets until they're eaten. And the problem is once the birds, the chicken roll gets into the pigs and the pigs are cooked and eaten, that is the transition from the birds to the pigs to the humans. See, all of humanity, all 9 billion of us, is just a fly speck on the windshield of viral life. The viruses infinitely prefer birds, which were around before humans, and they were evolved to live in their intestinal tracts and vector through them. And the avians provide an enormous biomass in which for viruses to mutate. So all flus are avian flus, and all flus are swine flus. Just something to educate the public on in terms of the misnomers when they throw these terms out at you, like avian flu or swine flu. So and
well,
they all
everybody's heard about the bird flu.
Bird flu. But, yeah, like I was saying about the Western states and their sense of independence, when I was trying to segue into a career as a think tanker, I remember I was talking to the RAND/MIT people, and they said, well, what do you think is in America's future? And I said, you know, at the same time, while I was predicting in the late 1980s, early 1990s, I was predicting the reunification of Germany and the collapse of the Soviet Union, said the United States eventually, if it were to collapse into a civil war, it would be the total opposite of the Chinese Civil War. I pointed out that the Chinese Civil War was one in which over 90% of the population, close to 99% in many regions, was rural. They were all farmers. They were all agrarian. And it became a war of the urban gangsters against the rural bandits. And the urban gangsters became monopolized, co-opted by the nationalists, and the rural bandits were co-opted by the communists. And the rural bandits won out because they had a hold of all of the food. The cities were under siege, and their only way to supply was through rivers and through the coast. And without foreign aid and intervention, they were fighting a losing battle and ultimately had to relocate onto the island where I was born, the island of Taiwan, where the nationalist government exists till this day. And in the United States, the situation is just the opposite. I pointed out that 90 to 99%, depending on where the region is being analyzed, of the American population lives in the cities. And less than 1% in many areas, or up to about 9% or so, lives in the 17 Western states. And an enormous amount of farming is done there, and the rest of it is just mountains, missile silos, Mormons and militiamen. And I pointed out that because of that, the next American Civil War would not be North versus South, but East versus West. And except for a very tiny strip of land along the western coast, which would include just a few miles inland to incorporate the cities of San Francisco and Los Angeles, etc., which is right along the coast, everything in the interior of Washington and Oregon and California would essentially go to a constitutionalist fundamentalist movement, is how I termed it. And these constitutional fundamentalists would be pretty much at ends with a very urban and developed, essentially socialized America that right. is developing through collectivization. And they would have to collectivize out of necessity because there's no way you can feed the population of the cities without collective distribution. And because of that, you would have kind of a communist versus militia set up. And that was how I analyzed it. Ironically enough, I was just appalled when a series named Jericho came on air, and that was about a nuclear civil war in the United States, and it vaguely alluded to a map along the lines which I had drawn for a think tank. So I highly suspect when they rejected me for that job at the think tank, telling me, Douglas Dietrich, none of our contractors wants to hear that. I'm sure somebody swept that idea, plagiarized it, and sold it to some movie writer somewhere and wound up on TV. So I'm still irked to this day.
You know what? I know people that think Jericho was another example of the powers that the powers that of the New World Order type that pre, you know, they pre-tell the events that are coming, you know, at least that they're planning. I inspired in Jericho is what's eventually going to happen in this country. I think it's very interesting. I think the path we're on, the trajectory we're on, certainly something's going to pop, and I don't know if it'll be, you know, I could certainly see a scenario where the strip that you're talking about from 100 miles inland on the West Coast, let's say over to the Midwest, where this is the new Afghanistan, this is the new Iraq, where you have a bunch of belligerent actors out here in the middle that have had enough and are pushing back. And anything that is said, you know, that is one bit contrary to what the line out of Washington, D.C. or the government line is going to be met with the full force of things like National Defense Authorization Act 2012, 2013. And, you know, the people that dare to speak out are going to be endangered for sure.
I've got two things to add into here. My my girlfriend just recently watched the back catalog of a number of different TV shows, Jericho being one of them, and she says to me, "Vinny, they created a new United States as a corporation, and it has a United States flag with the stripes going downwards, as is supposed to be the original peacetime flag of the United States." With 13 stars, which is an occult symbol, and she's like wide-eyed and stuff like that. And I was like, "Baby, I love it when you notice an Illuminati symbolism." And secondly, here's an article in here from Duffelblog.com. This is in the top 7,000 websites in America. Military. This is poignant for Veterans Day, I think. Military absentee ballots delivered one day late would have swung election for Romney.
Well, yeah.
So, DC, this is out of DC. Sources confirmed today that hundreds of thousands of military absentee ballots were delivered hours after the deadline for them to be counted, with preliminary counts showing that they would have overturned the vote in several states and brought a victory for Governor Mitt Romney. Officials say the ballots were delivered late due to problems within the military mail system. I'm sure that was just an accident. Tracking invoices show the ballots sat in a warehouse for a month. Then they were accidentally labeled as ammunition and shipped to Afghanistan.
Did you just make that up? Is that for real?
You can't make this stuff
no,
up.
No, you can't. Yeah, you can't make that up. No, that's typical government at work. It's typical military at work. Which, you know, it was something similar happened in the Clinton administration, and the military overwhelmingly, of course, votes conservative or Republican, and fact that this was done was obviously orchestrated, and I'm certain that no matter what happened, they would have tipped the electoral votes to bring Obama back in power because they didn't want to see riots in the cities, because the majority of Americans voted for a change, and as illusory as that change was, no one in power wanted to take that risk. They didn't want to take the risk of – it didn't matter if the change was going to be totally illusory. The public didn't know that. And a different face would have made a lot of people worried that a lot of social programs were going to be cut the way they were threatening. And
yeah, you know what? And here's the deal. I know that the – I mean, I know as well as you guys do that George Soros controls a lot of the voting machines. Like I think it was 30 states that are – these voting machines are counted – are made by a Spanish company that George Soros happens to own. I've heard the stories, all kinds of stories about telescreens not working right. But, you know, I think the point is it just doesn't matter. It doesn't matter if we'd have had Romney or Obama. Now, to take all conspiratorial slant away from this and just look at even what the mainstream has given us to digest on this, here's the deal. Romney, I said this for months coming up to the election. Matter of fact, I've got multiple ounces of silver sitting right here because people are starting to pay up on the bets because everybody thought Romney was going to win this thing. I said, no, he's not. He's not going to win this thing. And this was even after the first debate, second debate. I said, look, here's the deal. Regardless of how you feel about it, he's a Mormon, first of all. Look how hard it was for Kennedy as a Catholic to get elected. Right. Secondly, he started talking. He started downgrading women, or at least things that he said were taken that way and spun that way. when he's talking about he has a file or a binder full of women candidates, blah, blah, blah. You know, he was stepping in it almost on every turn. Then he did the 47% thing, right or wrong. That grabbed hold. So you have a Mormon candidate that has already talked down to women who are vote more than men do. And then you talked about self-deportation, and you have the Latina vote, Latino vote that is the largest minority vote in this country. The guy was destined to fail by sticking his foot in his own mouth to begin with. And, you know, there is a lot of hype, especially an alternative about, you know, potential stuffing the ballot box or cheating or collusion or whatever. And maybe that's true, maybe it's not true. But my whole point is that the candidate that was given to us, Romney, or that was presented by the Republicans, I think he was presented as a flawed candidate to begin with. It could be exactly to your point, Douglas, that they didn't want anybody but Obama in there. So they're going to present somebody like Romney. I was not surprised at all it turned out the way it did. But again, I think the biggest point is the same people that really run the show, the same people writing legislation, the same people dictating policy, they're still in power. They're still in power if Romney got in or Obama.
Right. Absolutely.
Well, and that's something else I wanted to say as well. That I knew, just like you, Charlie, no, Romney's not going to win. Obama's going to win. Why? Because he was sent to destroy the United States, and it ain't destroyed yet.
Well, there you go. I had a take on it that, you know, another factor is this. I've done multiple videos on the fact that over 50% of the country right now, and I'm not saying this in a denigrating way to the people that receive some kind of assistance. I'd rather see my fellow American receive a check than I would, a Wells Fargo or Goldman Sachs. But over 50% of the people in this country receive some form of government assistance, be it state, local, federal, in order to put food on their table. I mean, that's just the way it is. That's a very, very, very powerful motivating factor for people to go to the balloting place and vote for this administration you have now, especially when Romney and Ryan, their mantra was more austerity, tougher living. Well, you're talking to over half the country that's receiving some kind of a social safety net at this moment. So that's another.
That's why the powers that be were worried about the cities burning down. Were Romney going to be elected? But with that 50% in mind. In the time that we have left before our next break, here's something else that comes into mind with that. Since it's Veterans Day, the entire military, as I've mentioned before, in the United States, and I agree with you, Mr. McGrath, every nation is essentially a perimeter of defense. We the military is very much not just a part of the nation state. The military is a part of the human condition. If we really did not make war on each other in a very real sense, we would not be human. And that is one of the odd things about the condition of humanity. The most natural tribal states in New Guinea through South America, they only kill tribal wars a year. But proportionately, they're almost killing as much as modern industrial states do when they go to war because of the paucity of their population base. So we have this human condition where war is involved. It'd be hard not to imagine humanity without it. We would almost be like the Borg. So with that in mind, defense is important, and certainly the military is important. But what we're talking about is, of course, rehabilitation. Our military has gotten so corrupt because at 2.5 million people, even if we include the entire civilian Department of Defense, which is just 100,000 people, we've got 2.5 million people. Now, with America being the third largest population on Earth after India and China, with 350 million people, 50 million of those being illegal, that's less than 1% of the population. So with that in mind, you've got this less than 1% of the population with all the services put together, including the Coast Guard, with the National Guard and all the reserves, and yet it gets every year through the annual discretionary fiscal income budget that they lobby for, it gets over 50% of that income. And so it gets about 51%. And with that in mind, you talk about the 1%, this is it. But none of it is going for veterans care. None of it is going towards retirement. The amount going towards that is minuscule. It doesn't even count. It's practically nil. It's all going towards defense contracts, towards black budget research development programs, which don't reach the field because we have no mass production in the country. When we developed the stealth bomber, we were only able to throw out a wing of them, 20 of them. about half of which were in repair at any time, just like our carriers. We had 14 super attack carriers. Half of them are in dry dock at any time. So with that in mind, when we come back from the break, I'd like to talk about what your idea might be about military rehabilitation and, you know, hear what you have to say about that, Mr. Greenbrand.
Unfortunately, I don't think Charlie is going to be with us for one more segment. Will you, Charlie? Yep.
No, I'm going to take off. I'm very sorry.
Okay. It's all good, man.
I'm very sorry.
You've got your show starting very soon. WideAwakeNews.com, ladies and gentlemen, if you want to listen to Charlie right after this program. We'll be right back. Ladies and gentlemen, to the Vinnie Eastwood Show. We're broadcasting live from New Zealand, live from the future, where is already tomorrow. That's how I knew the election results before anybody else. Obama would win, everyone would win. No, I'm kidding. Okay, now, the show is much like a bathtub. It's pretty freaking useless without a plug. So, Douglas, proceed.
Thank you, sir. I would like people who are interested in the information that I have to disseminate to check out my website, www.douglasdietrich.com. Douglas is spelled with one S, and Dietrich is spelled just like the famous actress Marlena Dietrich. For those of you who are too young, like Vinny, who's about a little shy of 17 years old and is not legal drinking age yet, just put the words diet and rich together, D-I-E-T-R-I-C-H. So DouglasDietRich.com, and there you will find an offer. Two things you'll find. One, you'll find the big blue F for the Facebook button, and you can follow me on my public timeline where I put up a lot of posts that are historical in nature, and you can follow up for a lot of sites or citations and sources and references for many of the facts that I bring up, which are so shocking to the public because this hasn't been taught to them in the history books or spread by the news. And the other thing you'll find is, of course, an order button for my set of DVDs if you want them. And there's very few of them left, so I do encourage people to get them while they are still available. We did burn off another run because of popular demand, but there is not much of that. And that will be gone before the end of the holiday season. And the two DVDs within that DVD set, which is being offered to for the price of one through the holiday season. One of them is Roswell and the Rising Sun, which unfortunately the production thereof led to the death of my mother, and that would be the subject for perhaps another interview. But it was there that I spoke about the Battle of Los Angeles in great technical detail, as well as the collateral damage incidents of the Second World War, which between Japan and America legally lasted until the Treaty of San Francisco, which was signed at the Presidio Military Base, where I was stationed for many years. It went into effect on April 27th of 1952. So until that period of time, Japan and America were legally at war. And the many prisoners of war, Korean, Taiwanese, and Japanese, and there were Koreans and Taiwanese in Japanese service in the Second World War, they were never returned home, 15,000 of them. And they died here under torture, and many of them were used in experiments with unconventional aero technology, and that was one of the reasons for Roswell, and hence the title Roswell and the Rising Sun. The other DVD, by the way, one of the reasons we're getting rid of that DVD is because it was made very much in a hurry because of the stress we were under with all the threats we were facing, and we didn't even have a screen up, but the images still show up quite clearly. It was filmed very digitally and very professionally. Despite that, other than that, we're analoging that into text format, and we'll come out with the book version soon enough. The other DVD in the set, Satan's Crusaders, is about the satanic influence or the infiltration of satanic cults into the United States military. I could speak to this with great authority because I did serve as liaison to the U.S. Army's officially recognized satanic chaplain, Colonel Michael Aquino, for almost a decade. And so you will see footage in that DVD or, photos you will not find anywhere else. I took actual photos of animal sacrifices and human sacrifices that were conducted on site at the Presidio Military Base, the victims thereof, using a miniature spy camera because I was trained in the use of such at the same City College of San Francisco criminology course, that trained Anton Zandor LaVey, the founder of the Church of Satan in San Francisco. And as a result, I will be speaking of the contents of that DVD at the next Super Soldier Summit, which will be held in Las Vegas around March of 2013. So that's another reason why we're fading that DVD out or phasing it out. So both those available for the price of one while they last. The books that I speak of, we will start taking orders for them, or pre-orders, around the time of Pearl Harbor Memorial Day, around December 7th, and they should be out around February of 2013. And one of them is, of course, Roswell and the Rising Sun, and the other would, of course, be The Reality of the Red Undead, The Untold Story of the Supernatural Soviets, in which I reveal what I can about Soviet documents that were interpreted as disinformatio, or disinformation, by the American intelligence, both military and civilian. But the Soviets were claiming that vampires were quite real, a subspecies of genus Homo sapiens that had been around for many thousands of years. They were working with them, and they had also claimed that they had basically synthesized the Podzombi, or the zombie formulary, of Haiti, which had been passed to them through Cuba, because voodoo is practiced throughout the Afro-Caribbean nations. And as a result, under the Castro regime, some Bokors gave the voodoo formulary or pharmacopoeia to the Soviet Union, which synthesized it to use it on political dissidents, and ultimately used it, these political dissidents, against the Chinese in the war of 1969, the Sino-Soviet border conflict, as weapons of mass destruction. But finally, of course, we have Nexus Magazine, which is published out of Australia. And I did a very long interview in the German language with Mr. Thomas Kirschner of Nexus United Germany. And this was transcripted into a series of installments that have been in the last three issues of Nexus Magazine, including the one which is currently circulating. It's important to remember that Nexus Magazine is not allowed to circulate in the United States. So you can only find it through subscription, or you can find it via nexusmagazine.com, www.nexusmagazine.com, and Nexus is spelled N-E-X-U-S. And I talk about the thousand-year Reich in exile, and spoke about the actual space combat that went on between Americans and the Third Reich in exile while it still had a space program, which was no longer extant after Operation Argus, a series of nuclear strikes near the Antarctic region, which created an artificial Van Allen radiation belt 40,000 miles into the sky and radiated all of near space and destroyed all hard vacuum assets of the Third Reich in exile. After that, space was considered so dangerous because of the impact of radiation that the Soviets and the Americans fought space combat pretty much hand-to-hand by smashing in each other's face plates with wrenches and killing each other with knives in close combat. And there were field manuals on space combat. I shared these with my co-writer, David West, who popularized this in a fiction novella called Gods in Darkness. This is anthologized in to a anthology called Space Eldritch, which is published by Cold Fusion Press and has made it to number two on Amazon.com. And went down again a bit, but probably has gone up again since my last appearance on Coast to Coast AM. So people can check that out to see, get a popularly accessible and legible presentation of what space combat really was like in the 1950s and 60s with the American covert space programs. And finally, of course, I have my radio shows for anyone who wants to follow up with me. And those are only Saturday and Tuesday nights, 10 to midnight Eastern time. Saturdays is Saturday Night Firing Lines, on which I take open calls, and Tuesday nights I have a guest on Critical Omissions. And both of these are available on Revolution Radio through freedomslips.com. Once again, that's www.freedomslips, as in speaking when we speak of freedom. Freedomslips.com is an easier way to remember that. So thank you very much for allowing me to bring all of that up, Mr. Eastwood. You have the patience of a saint.
All right, and so does our caller. He's been hanging on for a few minutes there. Caller in a 314 area code. You are on the air. Are you there?
Hello.
Yeah, you're on. Yes.
Hey, what's up?
Hi.
I'm calling your show. I'm starting to call into your show, and I really like what's going on. You guys bring up some interesting points, but what I do never hear about is the Jesuit order. I never do hear about that. Never.
Oh, we had the Reverend Ted Pike on the show a while back. And I think he was talking about that a little bit. And we've had a few other guests as well in the past that have talked about it. I haven't had any guest suggestions relevant to that since, though, because we kind of already covered it.
Well, I was calling in and I wanted to talk about that. I was wanting to talk about how they're creating this new age religion and how, you know, how they've based it off aliens and, you know, haven't shared the series.
Transhumanism.
It's an alien. Hello?
Yeah. It's called transhumanism. Your line's pretty crackly there, bro.
Yeah. Well, yeah, I'm in Missouri, and there's a lot of trees around and stuff, so.
Cool.
And I was watching this the other day, and you start to see how they're starting to tell people that, you know, they're starting to tell people that basically everything that humanity has done, aliens have created. Aliens have put it in our brains to do. And they're basically telling us that to, you know, unlock our full human potential, you know, we have to let the aliens, you know, let us awake our subconscious and stuff. And it's like, people are really buying into this. And the Vatican's in support of this new age religion, and it's sprouting up pretty big.
Believe it, man. I hear so much about this from so many new ages. Oh, the Pleiadians are going to come and save us. I won't have to take any personal responsibility anymore. I'll just lay down and let the entire New World Order march and wash over everybody and completely destroy everything.
Yes.
Yeah. I want to thank you for your call, man, but we've come to the end of the show.
Right.
So, Douglas, if you've got like about 20 seconds to ramp up on that topic if you'd like.
Yeah, when I was liaising with the satanic chaplain of the U.S. Army, Colonel Aquino, he took personal charge. He was recalled from Vietnam back in 1969 when Sergeant Melvin Brown started to talk about Roswell. And Melvin Brown, when men landed on the moon, turned towards his family and said, "I worked with the enemy aliens." And he was talking about the Japanese. He said, "I peeked under the tarp. I saw the bodies. They were yellow, burnt orange, turned gray with rigor mortis." When the U.S. Army said, "Hey, this is an Army problem," because the Air Force wasn't created yet in 1947, they recalled Colonel Aquino and they said, "We want you to propagandize this and spin the alien theme so that everybody buys it." When he came back, he went to the town of Roswell. He talked to the elders. He says, "I can make you a deal with the devil that you can't refuse. We're moving this military base under Lyndon Baines Johnson to Texas. And the only way your town's going to maintain itself is if you agree to do what I say. Then you'll get all the money you want and then some." And so they agreed to the alien myth, became the Medjugorje, the lordess of a new religion. That was the genesis of America's UFO cult. And for every senior that died, he had everybody else watch like vultures so that they could sign an admission that they saw extraterrestrials as opposed to Japanese prisoners of war. And for everybody who signed off to that, he would put another soul on the pegboard. He had a pegboard. He said another soul consigned to hell.
Here we go. See you again. That's-